Headlines: a deepening row over fishing waters. Britain says it reserves the right to respond to France's seizure of a British trawler a day after London summoned the French envoy. Lebanon's Hezbollah movement condemns as unjust a Saudi-led campaign against the Lebanese minister over his remarks about the war on Yemen. Also ahead, official data shows the United States had a slow economic growth over the summer amid coronavirus restrictions and a supply chain crisis. Welcome to the program. A dispute worsening between France and the UK over post-Brexit fishing rights. The UK, angry over France's seizure of a British trawler in French waters, says it reserves the right to respond in a proportionate way. Environment Secretary George Eustace says it's always possible for Britain to increase its required measures on French vessels. On Wednesday, France detained one British fishing boat and issued a warning to another one in its waters. Paris said the detained boat lacked proper license and its captain will face trial next August. Paris did so in retaliation for London denying fishing license to EU boats, including the French ones, operating in British waters. Paris has threatened more retaliatory measures starting as of next week if talks do not progress. Britain has called the threats unjustified and summoned the French ambassador for explanations. It's time for our news review. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah has condemned a Saudi-led backlash against the Lebanese minister over his remarks critical of the war on Yemen. Hezbollah praised what it called a courageous position of Information Minister George Kordahi in defending the oppressed people of Yemen. The movement said the campaign by Saudi Arabia and its allies against Kordahi is unjust. Kordahi has said the Saudi-led war on Yemen was futile and it's time to end the conflict. He has also said Yemen's Ansarullah forces are defending themselves against an external aggression. Kordahi made those comments in an interview before taking office. The interview was aired earlier this week. Following that, Saudi Arabia, the UAE, Bahrain, and Kuwait summoned Lebanese ambassadors to their respective capitals to protest Kordahi's remarks. To discuss that issue a little bit further and for more insight, perhaps, I'm going to bring in Mr. Hadi Kobayashi. He is an author and political commentator who joins us via Skype out of Beirut. You have Honorable Saeed Shahabi. He's a political analyst who joins us via Skype out of London. Gentlemen, it's good to have you with us. I'm going to begin with perhaps the word in Beirut from the mouth of Hadi Kobayashi. Hadi, we're with you. Would you begin your comments, please, sir?
The Minister of Information or Media, George Kordahi, have a statement before he is before 2 months. He have a statement on Al Jazeera, and he have a comment about the destructive war in Yemen. And after he is going to be minister, the Al Jazeera put the video, and there is a lot of comments, formal comments and informal comments from the Saudi Arabia and media, Lebanon and outside Lebanon. And there is a political crisis from this comment. This is, you remember us of the Khashoggi case. Any critics of the Saudi politics we will see a huge comments and a huge attack in the from the Saudi media. This is a big problem, and Kordahi speak in a language with the language of international community, and he said that this war is destructive and is without any target and without any goal, and is not a legal or a just war. But when any Arab said the same, and any Arabic figure, when he said the same language of the international community about this war, we see the orchestra of Saudi media make a huge attack against him. from Egypt, from Emirates, from Saudi Arabia. We see this attack 3 days. This attack doesn't stop till now.
Okay, Sayed Shahabi, what do you think about this? You know, such a reaction by all these Arab countries, you know, all of a sudden, you know, over something that seems to be the case, you know, by all means, when you look at the conflict in Yemen, you know, a stronger power, Saudi Arabia, you know, being going on for the past 6 years, so many civilians dead. You know, what other type of comment would Saudi Arabia really expect, you know, to hear on that issue?
Thank you very much, and thanks to our colleague there with you in Beirut. I do not know what they expect. I don't know what they expect. They expect to be praised. This is what they want from their mouthpieces. This is what their mouthpieces are doing. And it is not good for them. It's not good for them to hear the words of praise when their soldiers are dying, because they are not supposed to be. These soldiers are wrongly put in action on Yemen. Why should they go and attack Yemen? What for? Who has given them the right to go and attack a neighboring country because one faction has attained a stronger position? Okay, Al-Houthi, at the end of the day, whom they call Al-Houthis, they are called officially the Ansarullah movement. They are in charge. They got power, and they are in charge of their country. What right does Saudi Arabia have to go and crush Yemenis and create the worst humanitarian crisis in the region? So they expect people, they just clap for them. Yes, you have done very good. Well done. No, they expect people to praise them when they killed Khashoggi. They expect people to kill to praise them when they killed and executed and beheaded Ayatollah Namer. And they expect the people to also praise them when they sentenced 2 Bahrainis to death earlier this month. So, but for a minister from Lebanon to say, and to say the truth, that this is a futile war, this is totally unacceptable to them, because they don't want the wise words from people who are independent and who are neutral. They only want words of praise, and that's not going to help them at all in a war which they have lost totally, morally and militarily.
Sure. Hadi Kobayashi, of course, we know the reaction that Hezbollah has shown to the comments made by Mr. Kordai, has called them a courageous move. I'm not really sure if I've heard any official position on the Lebanese media, Lebanese government, and Lebanese people on how he has commented on the Yemen war.
Our government is afraid from the Saudis, and any comment from the Saudis make them build their speech or their discourse in the same language of the Saudis. They copy the Saudis' comments and remake them in the media of Lebanon and the formal statements of the Lebanese government. This is a case of freedom of speech. He doesn't insult anyone. He doesn't attack the Saudi Arabia. He said that this is a war of energy, and this is a war without any and same the Americans today want this war to stop and want the siege to stop over Yemen. But the Saudis doesn't, just like Mr. Shahab said, they don't think even in their interest. And the Saudi interest and the interest of the whole Saudi community and the government of Saudi family, their interest is to stop war. This war is making a lot of problem in the economy and the international figure of the Saudi Wahhabi family. They have a lot of, and this really is a war of honor, and there is no future for this war. But this point, nobody asked them, nobody even described this war by a language of reality. They want the journalists to say what they love to and they want to, from the journalists, to describe this war as a victory for the Saudi family and a big, project for the Saudi family. This is a big problem. And the other problem is the interference of Saudi Arabia in the media, in all the world, even in the United States and in the European states, and in Lebanon, such in the situation in Lebanon now, the failed economy of Lebanon and the weak government that is now, permit for Saudis to interfere and to enforce this government to make this failed statement about the Kirtah case. This is a big problem to interfering just deeply in the government of Lebanon and in the journalism everywhere by money and by terror. Mm-hmm. The Khashoggi case is still now making the atmosphere of terror and of brightness from everywhere. Everyone wants to say any word about Saudi Arabia, he will remember Khashoggi and
That's exactly what I was just going to point out, Hadi. Mr. Shahabi, Hadi just brought up a very nice point. You know, if it's going to be the atmosphere and the climate of stifling on the voices who want to speak their minds, be it ministers or ordinary people or media, the treatment that Mr. Kordahi receives in this is very, very important, I would imagine, in encouraging other people to come out and speak their minds. What do you think this will unfold in the next, few weeks or months as far as people speaking their minds about what Saudi Arabia is, how Saudi Arabia is treating its neighbor, Yemen?
Well, number one, Saudi Arabia is a dangerous country. They tried their luck in Bahrain in 2011. 10 years ago, they sent their troops into Bahrain. In 2015, they sent their troops and attacked Yemen. And they have threatened, in the past, threatened Qatar in 1986 and the subsequent year. So these people are dangerous. Number two, people will continue to speak up their minds. They cannot silence everybody. Of course, we know that anybody who speaks, if he's inside Saudi Arabia, will have his head chopped off, like what has happened to Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. We know that. We know, and this is what happened to Khashoggi. They only spoke. They said they did nothing but speak out their mind. And then their end was clear. Now, if George Qaddahi was in Saudi Arabia, definitely he would have been beheaded, slaughtered. But is this a state in the 21st century? Is this what statehood is all about? I believe that people will raise their voices inside and outside Saudi Arabia, and they cannot win a war in which they kill people for speaking out their mind. This is they should stop this policy and stop the war, stop the hooliganism, and stop the attacks on neighboring countries and on their own citizens. That's the best for everyone.
Many, many thanks, both of you. Gentlemen, Hadi Kobayashi, author and political commentator out of Beirut, as well as Honorable Said Shahabi, is a political analyst out of London. Thank you very, very much, both of you. Have a very good day. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has called on the Security Council to force Israel to end its occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights.
Or further delay. In this context, the Security Council must live up to its responsibility and compel the Israeli regime to end the occupation of the Syrian Golan and also stop immediately its aggressions against Syria. Aggressions and destabilizing measures of the Israeli regime constitute flagrant violations of international law and continue to threaten regional and international peace and security. The assassination on October 16.
Tahrirabanchi added, all occupying and uninvited foreign forces should leave Syria without any precondition or further delay. The Iranian envoy also spoke of what he described as the dire humanitarian situation in Syria. He said further efforts are needed to alleviate the suffering of Syrians and help reconstruction there. Tahrir Rabbani said to reach those goals, all unilateral and coercive sanctions against Syria should be lifted, among other measures. He said those sanctions are only used for the collective punishment of the entire population in Syria. The UN General Assembly's first committee has adopted an Iranian-drafted resolution calling on nuclear-armed states to dismantle their entire nuclear arsenal. A resolution calls for an end to production of nuclear weapons and requires nuclear-armed states not to transfer such weapons to other countries. It also calls on the Israeli regime to join the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and allow UN inspectors to access its facilities. The adopted text says non-nuclear states would be given assurances that they would not be attacked or threatened with nuclear weapons. The United States and the Israeli regime were among the countries that voted against the document. The United States has had a slow economic growth over the summer. That's what data released by the Commerce Department has shown. Based on the data, gross domestic product adjusted for inflation grew 0.5% in the third quarter. That was down from 1.6% in the second quarter, I should be saying. The economic growth in the third quarter, lasting from July to September, was the slowest in the U.S. in more than a year. The slowdown is partly blamed on the spread of the COVID Delta variant that restricted activities, including summer travels. Also contributing to the slowdown was a global supply chain crisis causing shortages of goods, leading to higher prices despite rising demands.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
A new regionalism has taken form out of the multipolar world order with the characteristics of spontaneous movements grown out of international regions. As the world struggles to adjust to the transforming and globalizing trends, regional countries find it pragmatically essential to cooperate locally. In return, modern regionalism offers them a more comprehensive and multifaceted solution compared to regional integrations of the past. It goes far beyond the realms of free trade and economic development and addresses environmental, social, and security issues as well. The success of regionalism in Europe is a good testament for nations who are still hesitant about regional cooperation despite the existence of common economic, cultural, and geopolitical characteristics and a need for greater regional empowerment. In the economic sphere, new regionalism has been extremely effective in helping to secure markets and providing economic strength through the creation of regional trade agreements. In line with these transforming developments, the Islamic Republic of Iran has entered into a few regionalization processes itself. As part of this new strategy, it has put cooperation and convergence with the Eurasian Economic Union on its agenda. The EAEU bloc offers the Islamic Republic a combination of dependable trade, diplomacy, and counter-Western alignment that could be meaningful to Tehran in its international relations. In the past few years, and especially throughout the coronavirus pandemic, China has replaced Europe as the main trade partner of Iran. This has been one of the few positive experiences in the international arena for Iran in recent times. Building on this positive experience, Tehran has shaken up its economic diplomacy by looking north in addition to the east as a way to diversify its partnerships and regional cooperation. For a more in-depth look at Iran's new regional policies and its goals in cooperating with Russia in the framework of the Eurasian Economic Union, stay with us on this week's edition of Iran Today. The U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement, or JCPOA, during Trump years and its extensive sanctions against Iran, in addition to Russia's geopolitical difficulties with the West, have led these two countries to expand their cooperation within the framework of the Eurasian Economic Union. So far, the results show that aside from the economic benefits of the agreement, its political and geopolitical goals are also of high significance for both Iran and Russia. Mr. Zangane is member of the Parliamentary Plan and Budget Committee and spokesperson for the Committee on a Production Leap. He's also a researcher, economist, and Allama University professor. Let's hear him out.
I think that if we focus our attention on Eastern countries, especially those in Central Asia, East Asia, as well as Eastern Europe, instead of focusing on the West, we can definitely benefit from their considerable economic potential. As you are aware, we are facing a lot of challenges in interacting with Western countries because of the United States and Israel's attitude toward Iran. But the same challenges don't exist in our ties with Eastern nations. That creates a great opportunity for our economy.
Iran is an important consumer market for the region, and the development of relations with this country is of high importance for the EAEU members. Given the ongoing illegal US and EU sanctions on Iran, its economy is now seeking the Eurasian markets to replace lost European trade and investment. Mr. Mohaqiq Nia is a specialist in economy. He'll be sharing his views with us.
Last year, while almost the entire world saw negative economic growth because of the coronavirus, China's economy grew by 9.8%. Considering how big China's economy already is, a country whose GDP is $14 trillion, a 10% economic growth is very significant. That makes China an emerging power. It needs countries like Iran to continue that growth. We also need to correct the unbalanced view toward the West and also look at the East. We can define a win-win situation which will ultimately benefit the people. That would be made possible only if we bring investors from the East to Iran.
The EAEU region is located at the eastern end of Europe, bounded by the Arctic in the north, the Pacific Ocean to the east, and Eastern Asia, West Asia, and parts of Central Asia to the south. This region accounts for about 15% of the world's land mass, 2.4% of the world's population, and 2.2% of the world's GDP. Mr. Modabbir is a specialist counselor on the Russian Federation and Eurasian Economic Union, as well as the Shanghai Security and Economic Organization. Let's hear him out.
The Eurasian Economic Union was an upgraded version of the Customs Union initiated by Russian President Vladimir Putin with the aim of breaking Western sanctions and restricting the unilateral pressure the US imposed on emerging and powerful nations. You know that the Russian Federation is also a member of the World Trade Organization, but because of the Americans' tendency to pressure emerging powers, such as the Russian Federation, the Russian side initiated the union with its allies. The Eurasian Economic Union has grown to the point where more than 40 countries are now in line to join.
The member states established the union based on a certain understanding of their long-term economic objectives, creating a single market for trading goods, services, and capital distribution of labor forces among member states, as well as the highly ambitious goal of creating a customs union.
One of the most important capacities and programs in the Eurasian Economic Union, which is exactly like the World Trade Organization, is the abolition of customs tariffs between its members and, most importantly, the investment program in the member states aimed at the coordination of the growth and development of the Eurasian Economic Union. We have a very important clause in the Union's documents called knowledge exchange. The member states can use this opportunity to exchange knowledge amongst themselves. They can also exchange workers and get them work visas within the union.
It's noteworthy that the interim agreement enabling the formation of a free trade area between the EAEU and the Islamic Republic was signed 9 days after the Trump administration withdrew from the Iran nuclear agreement in May 2018. And it came into effect on October the 27th, 2019. The FTA will become permanent within 3 years if pending talks work out. The objectives of the agreement are to liberalize and facilitate the trade of goods between the parties, primarily through reduction or elimination of tariff and non-tariff barriers relating to 502 goods and services by the Eurasian Economic Union and 360 items by Iran. Since 2018, the agreement with the Union has significantly increased Iran's exports to the EAEU and has been a major factor in boosting Iranian non-oil exports during the imposed U.S. sanctions. After the original FTA came into effect, Iran-EAEU trade immediately rose nearly 30% and initially reached $330 million a month.
There are almost a complete package of different areas we can have economic exchange with. Most of these countries are very fertile for agricultural products and are rich in water resources. Agricultural products constitute the majority of our imports. We can even do rental farming there, meaning that our farmers can take control of lands there and cultivate their crops. This also provides us with a unique opportunity for the transport sector, because Iran sits on a transit network to Europe on one side and the Far East through Russia, Kazakhstan, and Kyrgyzstan.
The U.S. has changed into a weaker country today. Those who are under the American media's hypnosis need to wake up and act according to their national interests. It's up to us whether or not we are restricted in the regional deals. Why didn't we join the Shanghai Cooperation Organization? There were some who thought that we first need to make deals with the U.S. because it might cause problems for us. We used to remind them that there are only two key nations in the SCO, namely Russia and China, and that making deals with them warrants our permanent membership in the treaty, but they would refuse to wake up from their illusions.
To remove obstacles and further ease the trade process, Iran has stressed the need to abandon the U.S. dollar in settlements and switch to national currencies. The EAEU has repeatedly stated that it is consistently moving towards this goal. Similar statements and practices are presently witnessed in bilateral relations between Iran and some EAEU member states.
The other issue is the national currencies and exchanging them with the other member states of the Eurasian Economic Union. This has already started. Currently, a majority of the financial exchanges that take place between the member states are denominated in their national currency. This creates a good opportunity for the Islamic Republic of Iran to reduce its dependence on the dollar to a great extent. This has also happened too. It's interesting to note that Russia has limited its currency's dependence on the dollar by some 50%, meaning that about 49% of its currency is dependent on the dollar.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
There's plenty more on rapprochement between Iran and the EAEU right after a quick diversion into world media.
Hello and welcome to the news part of the program with me, Sarah Adema. Today we will get into different media outlets to check out some reviews about the prospects of trade with Eurasian countries. Our first review from Newsweek is about a recent poll that shows Iranians losing faith in Biden and the West have hope for Raisi and the East. Most Iranians view U.S. President Joe Biden's policies toward their nation as being rooted in hostility, while majorities also had hope that their new political leader, President Ebrahim Raisi, would fulfill come through with key campaign promises, according to a recent poll. With this came a broader geopolitical shift of support away from the West and looking toward the East. The survey conducted by the University of Maryland Center for International and Security Studies at Maryland in conjunction with the independent Toronto-based Iran poll asked 1,001 Iranians their views on a range of subjects. As to rate Biden's policies, rated from a 0 of completely hostile to a 10 of completely friendly, 67% of respondents provided a score in the 7 to 4 range, more than half of which, 33.5%, chose 0. The second most popular answer was 5, neither friendly nor hostile, with 26.1%, while all scores above this were minimal. A majority of 44.1% that Iran should try more to strengthen its relations with Asian countries such as Russia, China, and India, and 39.1% saying the same for European countries like Germany, France, and the United Kingdom. We have another review here from Modern Diplomacy that reads, "The Emerging Eastern Axis and the Future of JCPOA." Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh recently said that Tehran would further strengthen its ties with Moscow via strategic partnership. Said Khatibzadeh, the initial arrangements of this document, entitled the Global Agreement for Cooperation between Iran and Russia, have been concluded. This agreement will be similar in nature to the agreement signed by Iran with China in March 2021, dubbed as the Strategic Cooperation Pact, which sought to enhance economic and strategic relations. China would invest $400 billion in infrastructure and oil and gas sector, while also strengthening security ties. Commenting on the same, Khatibzadeh also said that an eastern axis is emerging between Russia, Iran, and China. Closer ties with Russia are important from an economic strategic point of view and also to reduce Iran's dependence upon China. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian, on the eve of his Russia visit from October 5th to 6th, 2021, also stated that Iran, while strengthening ties, would not be excessively dependent upon either country. Our last review of the day comes from Tehran Times that writes, Iran and Kazakhstan aiming for $6 billion in annual trade. Iranian capital Tehran hosted an Iran-Kazakhstan business forum in October 2021, during which the two sides stressed the need for removing visa issuance and transportation obstacles to realize a $6 billion annual trade target. The business forum was attended by senior officials from both sides, including the head of Iran Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture, Olam Hossein Shafi'i, and Khairat Turabayev, Kazakhstan's Vice Minister of Trade and Integration. Speaking in the meeting, Shafi'i underlined the two countries' common cultural and religious backgrounds and said, "Our relations with neighboring countries have a special priority for the government, and Kazakhstan, as one of the largest countries in Central Asia, has an important place for us in Iran's foreign policy." That's it for me in today's edition. Bye-bye.
The idea of rapprochement between Iran and the EAEU has to be considered in the context of Iran's broader persuasive efforts towards greater regionalism and Eurasian cooperation. Tehran's activities with two other regional bodies, the Economic Cooperation Organization, ECO, and the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, SCO, is indicative of what lies ahead with the EAEU. Tehran's SCO pivot has been consistent with its long-standing balancing acts against Washington, and its outreach to the EAEU reflects the same mindset.
In the current situation, when we are under sanctions, I think one of the best strategies is that while we are continuing negotiations with the West and sitting at the negotiation table, as we are not afraid of dialogue based on the principles of the Islamic Republic and the revolution, the 13th administration must also have a special look to the East. And certainly if we can gain membership in the international treaties with regional unions in the East, like Eurasia, ASEAN, and etc., we can actually increase our power in the region, and that in itself has a deterrent power over the West.
Iranian policymakers are confident that the dependence of Iran and EAEU countries on trade with each other brings additional regional security in the process.
The Eurasian Economic Union is an economic arm that strengthens its member states. We don't consider it a mere economic pact. When it comes to improving the standards of members, there is also the issue of security. We have the northwest of Iran, both the northern and southern Caucasus, which is a strategic region where the American and Western sides have always wanted to incite sedition. They're now using Turkey as a tool to disrupt the region under various pretexts. Turkey is also a member of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. Eastern nations, by forging security alliances, seek to stand against the Western parties that want to disrupt the peace in the region.
Judging by what both Iran and the EAEU member states say, all the sides are intent on replacing the interim agreement with a permanent one. Iran, with its large population, is viewed as a strong economic power. In terms of nominal GDP, its economy ranks 22nd globally. Iran is also endowed with 9.5% of the world's total oil reserves and ranks fourth in the world in this category. According to data released recently by Iran's Customs Administration, IRICA, the value of non-oil trade between Iran and the members of the EAEU exceeded $1.6 billion in the first 4 months of the current Iranian calendar year, that's March 21st to July the 22nd, to register 93% year-on-year growth compared to 2020. In total, Iran exported over $385 million worth of commodities to the EAEU countries during that period, which accounts for an increase of 46%. This is while Iran's import from the EAEU reached $1.25 billion in the same period. Moreover, according to data published by the EAEU's executive body so far, nearly half of Iran's exports have gone to Russia, 40% to Armenia, and 10% to Kazakhstan. These export items include fruits, vegetables, nuts, cement, ferrous metal products, petroleum products, and natural or liquefied gas. On the other end, nearly three-quarters of Iran's EAEU imports have come from Russia, under 20% from Kazakhstan and 5% from Armenia. To take the next step, the Iranian government has announced that it's planning to reach $48 billion in non-oil exports to 15 neighboring countries, including Armenia, Kazakhstan and Russia in the near term.
In general, we need to increase our non-oil exports to $200 billion annually. This should be a short-term or at least a medium-term plan for us. We must not leave it to the long term. Achieving this target would turn us into a developed nation. All the economic fluctuations we're experiencing are because we lack sufficient exports and income. We need to start moving toward that goal. To that aim, it's essential that the Ministry of Foreign Affairs changes its approach and sets quantifiable goals and holds our embassies accountable so we hit the target. And they must take measures to solve the problems and take effective steps to facilitate that.
The Iranian ambassador to Russia, Kazem Jalali, has praised the level of ties between Iran and the EAEU, pointing out Iran's efforts in the field of logistics and the fact that Iran can facilitate Eurasian trade through regional corridors. Jalali was referring to a couple of rail and sea routes and noted, two very important border points of the Rasht Astara and Chabahar Zahedan railways are currently being completed.
In almost all important economic or cultural meetings in the world, the Islamic Republic of Iran is on agenda. It's possible that Russia, Eurasian countries, or those in ASEAN would give up some of their own economic interests to get closer to and do business with the Islamic Republic. There have been many examples that this did happen. There are many banks in China, Russia, and other Asian countries that are doing business with Iran, despite all the economic sanctions in place against Tehran. This shows that the Islamic Republic is important to them and that they choose to pay the price of getting closer to Iran.
Indeed, Iran's prime geostrategic position makes it a key node along the Eurasian transport corridors. For example, Russia and India have both been working on the infrastructure project of the International North-South Transportation Corridor, INSTC, which is now starting to become operational. The multimodal route allows transport of goods from India to Iran's Chabahar port by sea, then by rail across Iran with connections east to Afghanistan and west to Turkey. Further north, it reaches the Iranian Anzali-Caspian Sea port and free trade zone just north of Tehran. As such, Iran can become an ideal partner in unblocking its own connecting corridors while developing new transport and energy routes in the South Caucasus.
Another very important feature of the Eurasian Economic Union, which creates a tremendous opportunity for not only the Islamic Republic, but all member states, which is also present in the Security, Military and Cultural Shanghai Cooperation Organization, is the issue of transportation. Today, the international system prioritizes transit diplomacy. The most urgent issue in economic pacts is transit. Currently, the countries that are opposing the U.S. are looking for alternatives to replace transit routes, one of the most promising of which is a north-south corridor that passes through the territory of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
As far as the EAEU interests are concerned, analysts report that in addition to economic and security opportunities, Iran represents serious potentials for the Union's expansion. On the one hand, Iran will be the first non-Soviet country in the group, paving the way for other nations' membership. On the other hand, gaining access to warm waters on the Iranian shores of the Persian Gulf provides a significant geopolitical opening for the Eurasian Economic Union's member states. That's all for today. Thanks from the whole team. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after. Bye for now.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and I'm invited by Brother Mahdi to this segment of the program. Today, I'd like to read to you a passage about Islamic lifestyle according to Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. This passage is extracted from a book titled The Life of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Baqir, written by the great Iraqi Muslim historian and scholar Allama Baqir Sharif al-Qurashi. This great Muslim scholar and historian was born in 1344 AH in the city of Najaf. He's well known for his books on the biography and conduct of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. Please stay with me. Imam al-Baqir, peace be upon him, has said, "Fair acts prevent evil deaths from happening. Every fair act is alms. The people of fairness here are the people of fairness in the hereafter. The people of the abominable acts here are the people of the abominable acts in the hereafter. The people of the fair acts will be the first to enter paradise. The people of the abominable acts will be the first to enter the fire."
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the beautiful dialogues and conversations of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, this divinely appointed Imam, we find in his dialogue these beautiful pieces of wisdom which truly have the perfume of the divine. These pieces of advice and these golden conversations, if you will, really teach us a lot about life and the real meaning of the hereafter and the world. In one such conversation with his companions, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam responds to a question about what destroys faith. Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam replies that lying destroys faith. Lying destroys iman, as it is known in Arabic, faith. Lying, dear brothers and sisters, truly is one of the worst kinds of sins that a person can commit. And interestingly, it is one of the easiest sins that one can commit. And lying, my dear friends, has a whole array of different forms and varieties. For example, one is a very open and blatant and apparent and manifest lying, right? Another one is, for example, they're called white lies. So you promise something to a child and then you don't deliver. And you don't intend on delivering. Not that, you know, by mistake you didn't deliver, but you don't intend on delivering on that promise. This, dear friends, is lying. Now, lying is a disease. It eventually becomes an addiction. May Allah protect us from this addiction of lying. There are certain people, they are known as habitual liars, meaning that they can't, it's to a point where they can't even help themselves but to lie. This lying slowly but surely destroys our faith. And so if we want to increase our faith, if we want to strengthen our faith, our iman, if we really want to move forwards in our spirituality and in our belief in God, we must prevent ourselves from lying. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir, alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sheikh Hamza Sodagar.
Imam al-Baqir had an impact on the entirety of the Muslim community. It is true and obvious that those who accepted him as an Imam al-Muftarad al-Ta'ah, someone whose commands and orders needs to be obeyed, those who saw the Imam as someone who knows the knowledge of the Qur'an and the knowledge of the Sunnah of the Prophet and the previous revelations by divine decree and God giving it to him, obviously they would benefit more from such a person, because anything he says, whether he says, I heard my father from his father from the Prophet, or he didn't say that, they know it is from the same source. And so it's all reliable and it's all authentic. Those benefited more. The companions, Abu Hamza al-Thumali, who was a companion of Imam Zain al-Abidin and then the companion of Imam al-Baqir, he was able to benefit more from this man. Others who weren't were impacted and influenced on a lower scale, but they were still impacted and influenced. The circles of scholars that developed in Medina and the circles of scholarship, discussions, talk of different understandings of what the Prophet has said, what is the ruling in Islam, that becoming a discussion in itself and it becoming important for people to identify what the actual Islamic ruling is, that itself is very valuable, and that's the impact of what Imam al-Baqir did, in addition to all of which he shared of the Sunnah of the Prophet, which was documented, much of it, in the books of Hadith. Of those who don't identify as Shia, you do find these Ahadith, which are generally sayings of the Prophet that Imam al-Baqir has shared. This is why he's given the title.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.